2012, January 10th. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 6, The Geological Revolution, Deep Time and the Age of the Earth. So today is the third part of this five-part lecture series on five intellectual revolutions that are necessary to set the stage for beginning to ask the question of, is there life on other worlds? Previously, we looked at the Copernican Revolution, which asked about the place of the Earth and the place of human beings in the universe. We found ourselves as one planet circling the sun. We looked yesterday inward at the chemical revolution. What is the nature of matter? We began to see how people began to get an idea of what atomic theory was and how atoms work. Today I want to now switch gears to a different topic, what I like to call the geological revolution. The geological revolution is a series of intellectual advances that reveal to us the deep antiquity of the Earth. And so the subtitle of today's talk is Deep Time in the Age of the Earth. Having deep time turns out to be extremely important for understanding things like evolution, the arising of life on Earth, and also for setting some of the fundamental time scales, setting when the Earth was inhabitable, and in particular some of the time scales associated with when the Earth, what fraction of the Earth's age is inhabitable by intelligent creatures, i.e. us. So it's going to be important when we start considering the scale of planets, how much time you need, is going to have important inputs for understanding when we go out and look for life on other worlds. So the basic ideas today is we want to get at this geological revolution that revealed the deep antiquity of the Earth. Understanding what the age of the Earth is, in fact, requires having a conception that the Earth actually has a beginning. So it's a way of looking at time and the construction of time that's actually as important as the answer itself. We're going to review a couple of different ways in which people have addressed this problem, which are revealing, both using historical ages for the Earth and then trying to establish physical ages for the Earth and how that informs the inquiry into the idea of deep time. In particular, what I will reveal through this class is that the geological discoveries made primarily through sort of the late 18th through early 20th centuries were to reveal that the history of the Earth is very deep and very rich, and we're going to be tapping that history as we try to chart what the history of life was on Earth and the history of the climate on Earth, which sets the scale or conditions for Earth's habitability, and try to understand how that might translate elsewhere. In particular, it's how we've developed techniques for reading off that history and how that might apply to this larger question. And finally, one of the bottom lines that comes out of this lecture is the age of the Earth is actually pretty well known. It's known to about 1% now, which is pretty high precision given this magnitude of what's being measured. The Earth is 4.54 plus or minus 0.05 billion years old, and it's been measured through using techniques of radioactive age dating as applied to meteorites, the oldest Earth rocks, and moon rocks. And we'll see a little bit about how that radioactive age dating technique works. And it's going to become part of the principal method we use to set the fundamental time scale of events in the solar system. So when we want to investigate what's going on other planets, we'd like to know what the ages of those surfaces are and know something about how those planets evolve. And to do that, we have to have a way to set the time scale for our solar system. And we do that by referencing the ages of the Earth, meteorites, and moon rocks, which are the only rocks we've really sampled up to this time. Hopefully in the future we'll expand that. But a basic timeline emerges that in fact is quite good and self-consistent. Now, as I mentioned in a couple of the other lectures early in this class, in order to ask a question, that question must first philosophically make sense for you to ask. So when we ask about the age of the Earth, that implies that the idea that the Earth actually has a particular beginning at a particular finite point in the past must actually make sense to you. If you don't think of the Earth as having a beginning, if the Earth has always and always will existed, then asking the age of the Earth is kind of a meaningless question, or at least it's one that the answer isn't terribly meaningful. What this really gets down to is really addressing this question of the way in which people have conceived of the notion of time. There's two basic ways that we see through human history that people have conceived of time. The first of these, and actually an extremely common way of conceiving of time, is what we'll call cyclical time. The idea is that the Earth has neither a beginning nor an end. It has always existed, although there may be repeating cycles of birth, death, and then rebirth or revival, renewal, going on the surface of the Earth. So it's hard to really say what the age of the earth is. Is it in some kind of infinite age because it always existed and always will? Or do we set that age to be where we are in the current cycle? For example, Plato and other Greek philosophers viewed the earth as a cyclic history and then tried to figure out where we were in that current cycle. The other way of constructing time is perhaps more familiar to us in the 21st century, and that is the idea of linear time. The idea of linear time is there is no cycle of repeating. The earth has a very definite beginning and a very definite point in the past, and perhaps it means it will have a definite future end. So you bracket, you put bookends on the history of the earth. When was the earth formed? And when will the earth end its existence? That might be, in fact, a very, very long time, but we can actually talk sensibly about what that end might look like. It's coupled, for example, to the evolution and the development of the sun. The sun doesn't always shine. The sun had a definite beginning in the past and is going to have a very definite development into the future. So these two different ways of constructing time inform whether or not this question of what the age of the earth is actually makes sense. Let's look in a little bit more detail at what these are and see how these inform us or otherwise. Let's start, for example, with the idea of cyclical time. It's not a crazy idea. Okay, if you take everyday experience of life on the earth, there are an awful lot of cycles that occur. For example, there's the cycle of day and night. There's the cycle of the moon phases through the course of a month. You get the yearly cycle of the seasons in which you have, writ large, this idea of birth, renewal, and eventual death and decay as you walk through the seasons of spring and summer and fall and winter. Furthermore, even within human lifetimes on multi-generational scales, there is a cycle of birth, life, and death. And so seeing cycles elsewhere in nature, it's not surprising that various ways of thought actually thought that maybe the cycle of birth, life, and death closes upon itself and there's also a rebirth and a continuing cycle like that. That somehow the life ways of human beings somehow reflected these natural cycles we see in the everyday world. Some examples of where, in fact, cyclic reasoning, cyclic time has been perceived can be seen, for example, in the traditions of Hinduism and Buddhism, which posit cyclical time in their systems of thought. Plato, back in ancient Greece, posited that there was a 72,000-year cycle. We're not quite sure where he came up with the 72,000-year cycle, because with people like Plato, it's hard to sort of take apart metaphor and reality because they so much saw the world in symbolic terms. And Plato perhaps was using this idea of cyclic time, which was very common in the period, to try to make a moral or philosophical point. He thought there was, for example, a 36,000-year golden age, which was followed by a 36,000-year age of disorder and chaos, which would then close the cycle and you'd have another 36,000-year age, golden age of rebirth and renewal. The moral and philosophical point he was trying to make is that we were in the midst of the lowest point of the cycle of disorder and chaos, and it was his way of making a commentary on Athenian society of the 3rd century. But nonetheless, this idea of cyclical time bears within it a limitation. Asking the age of the earth kind of doesn't make sense. When the Buddha was asked what the age of the earth was, he mentioned that that was a topic which he has not considered because it is not conducive to enlightenment. In other words, your question doesn't make sense, dum-dum, don't ask it. Linear time is positing that there's a definite beginning in a past and an eventual ending in the future, although we often leave that ending somewhat open-ended, unless you're one of those people who digs the Mayan calendar and you want to think it's going to be December 21st, 2012. No, but, you know, it's fun to think, I guess, that way. For example, picking a thought system that was actually linear in its time, since we picked Hinduism and Buddhism, let's take something a little closer to home, perhaps for many of the people in this room, Judaism. Judaism is a good example of linear time. There's a past divine creation of the earth, described in the book of Genesis, and there is a promised end of times, which shows up in various works, usually mostly in the Apocrypha. Not surprisingly, Christianity and Islam, which came out of the Judaic tradition, both adopted at least aspects of the ancient writings, also adopted this idea. And the idea comes in that in a linear time way of viewing the world, you see history as a kind of fulfillment, but you don't necessarily see it as a growth. For example, one of the conceptions that's very common, and it's the primary way of looking at time and looking at human history through the Middle Ages and Renaissance, up really until about the 17th or 18th centuries, is the idea that there's really no fundamental change in the structure of the world itself, except in the sense that there's a decay from past perfection. If you will, to use a language very common, for example, a fall from grace. So it's kind of a variation on this theme of golden age and an age of corruption, in which you say that after the creation of the earth, everything is kind of just kind of wearing down and getting older, and eventually it's going to end sometime in the distant future. Well, one can certainly argue with details of this, and that takes up a whole course on comparative theology. What's important to know is that once you've adopted a linear view of time, asking the question how old the earth is now makes sense. It is a question which is in principle answerable, and the answer is in fact interpretable. It has meaning within your way of viewing the world. And this particular view of the world informed some of the first surviving estimates of the age of the earth that we know of, primarily from the late Middle Ages and early Renaissance into the modern age. And it's still argued about to this day among certain groups. Let's take one of these in particular, and I'm going to pick it out because, in fact, it is one of the most enduring historical age estimates that was made for the earth. It was done by a Protestant prelate by the name of James Usher, who lived in the 16th and 17th centuries. He was the Archbishop of Armagh, which is what is now Northern Ireland, and he was the leading classical and biblical scholar of his day. This is the age of, for example, the writing and construction of the King James Bible, which was one of the primary intellectual and historical exercises of England and the United Kingdom at the time. And James Usher played a significant role in much of the thought that went on at this time. Now, James Usher tends to be, I would say, purposefully misunderstood by modern geologists who have a particular axe to grind, right? They immediately focus on his answer, try to laugh it off. But if you really back up a little bit and you look at what James Usher was doing in the context of his time, he was a superb classical and biblical scholar. He was a really careful person about analyzing what is the oldest text, what are the corruptions of translation that one has to watch out for as texts are transmitted down to us over 1,000 or 2,000 years. Cripes, imagine a message going from this corner of the room to that corner of the room, what it's going to turn into, the old game of telephone. Now imagine you're doing that through multiple changes and upheavals of culture, language, idiom through that time. It's really hard sometimes to read ancient texts or be sure, am I reading an ancient text or a modern forgery? It's really hard to know that. And the standards of scholarship that Bishop Usher established are largely those that are used by historians today for the same way. He was a very good, at what I would say, in summary, he put together a critical chronology of human history, including in this the date of the creation of the world. His answer was actually published posthumously in a book in 1658 called The Annals of the World, the Annalen Mundi, in which he set the date of the creation of the earth as Sunday, 23rd of October, 4004 BC. Now, this seems like a suddenly arbitrary number, but in fact, on the Julian calendar, which he was working on, that's the first Sunday after the autumnal equinox in the year 4004 BC. So it's almost as if he got kind of close to the answer and said, oh, I know, I'm going to tie this to an astronomically relevant date when the sun is exactly on the celestial equator when there's equal day and equal night in the autumn. And it doesn't hurt to set it on the first Sunday, the first day of the Sabbath, or at least a Sabbath according to Protestant tradition, being Sunday instead of Saturday. And later, you'll often see this misquoted as saying at like 9 o'clock in the morning. That 9 o'clock in the morning was added by this guy named Lightfoot who was kind of adding on to Usher's work. Usher really stopped solid. He didn't set the time. This is one of the reasons why Usher's work is ridiculed, because of the exactness of which he is able to place this date, and also because basically his work was fundamentally misunderstood. Yes, he did use biblical chronology, but he also used chronology of other civilizations whose writings survived to us, and he tried to come up with a self-consistent chronology of human history. In many ways, what Usher was doing, and others who followed him who had variations upon this answer, were trying to made a basic assumption. They were assuming all of these historical ages made one fundamental assumption. And that assumption was that the human history and the physical history of the earth are the same thing. that the earth exists for the benefit of human beings, and therefore if you can trace human history, you've therefore traced the history of the earth. Now, this assumption is actually quite natural within the context of the prevailing cultural and religious thinking of, well, the late Middle Ages, early Renaissance. But there's a question that you get. Even isn't just Usher. It's also some of the giants of astronomy. Kepler, Newton actually made estimates of the age of the earth. Hevelius, who was an astronomer you won't know, but in fact was very famous for early telescopic observing, also made estimates of the age of the earth based on historical records. It was a very common practice at the time. And there's something that they all get about the same. They always end up about 4,000 BC, an age of the earth of about 6,000 years. And you got to wonder, why do they all converge on the same date? And the answer, as my mother used to say whenever someone says something, is consider the source. In this case, the reason that they're all going to get dates around 4,000 BC is they're using written records. Written records did not emerge in the Near East until the 4th millennium BC. In fact, really solid survivals written records are more like 3rd millennium BC. But those written records were based on oral traditions. Oral traditions can maybe survive a few centuries before they fade out. So it's not implausible that the reason why historical ages of the earth gave 4,000 BC is that's the start of the record. What they were dating was the start of written history. They weren't dating the physical age of the earth. They were tracing human history as reflected in the written record, and that written record is finite. Now, the question that you always have to ask is when you come up with an answer, even a consistent answer among different workers with different approaches, is underlying the question sometimes is a central assumption. What statisticians like to call the prior, the thing that's sort of setting the bias, the way, the basis upon which you craft your question and then proceed to construct an answer. So the question you always begin to ask, and this is the change between sort of historical philosophical thinking and scientific thinking, is you sometimes have to step back and say, what central assumptions go into my estimates, and are those assumptions valid? Is my central assumption correct? The central assumption they're working with here is that human history is synonymous with the physical history of the earth. If that assumption is correct, and I've already noted the limits of historical ways of estimating the earth, what if I go look for other ways that don't rely on the historical record, the human historical record? Do I get the same answer? So that's a way of testing the central assumption. Find other ways of estimating the physical age of the earth. If I get the same answer around 4004 BC, then I've got two different ways, fundamentally different ways of approaching the physical age. Has no such assumption buried in it that human history is synonymous with the history of the physical history of the earth. So let's go ahead and ask the question. The first person who really enters into this fray comes in the generation after Usher. It's one of the most famous but mostly unsung astronomers of this period, Sir Edmund Halley. We remember Edmund Halley primarily because of Halley's Comet and his great prediction of the reappearance of Halley's Comet that was to set Newtonian physics on its firm empirical basis. It was Edmund Halley who also, out of his own pocket, convinced the very reluctant Newton to publish the Principia Mathematica and actually paid for the first publication himself. He did a number of very far-reaching advances and has made a number of far-reaching advances in astronomy, and he also contributed to the question of the age of the Earth. What Halley did was ask the question, can we establish a physical age of the earth to compare, for example, to those 6,000-year-old ages which were coming up from people like Usher and Newton and Kepler? And what he did was he came across the following idea. Most water on landlocked areas coming down from fed from rivers and snow and rain is fresh water. We can drink it. But the vast oceans are salty. Now, he knew from experiments that the salts are basically dissolved into rocks. And so he thought, well, look, the oceans are fed by all the rivers coming off of all the land. As that water flows over the rock, they dissolve out salts in that rock and carry that salty water down into the sea. Rivers tend to be more saline, closer to the ocean than they are at their sources. So we know it's picking up these salts along the way. Let's assume for the moment that the oceans started out initially as purely fresh water, just like all the other water on the earth. Don't ask how they got there, just say they started out as pure water. How long would it take at the current rate of salinization to reach the level of salinity we see today? He could estimate the volume of the oceans. He could estimate the rate of salinization, of take-up of salt from rivers. He kind of knew roughly how many rivers there were in the world. World geography was pretty good by the end of Halley's life. He, in fact, traveled over much of that world himself. And when he came across with, he had a little trouble getting an exact number on this. In fact, it's interesting, in his paper, he never comes down and actually gives the answer, but he bracketed the plausible answer. He showed that if the Earth was only a few thousand years old, as predicted by the historical chronologies, then the oceans would still be mostly fresh water. There isn't enough time for the oceans to be as salty as they are. Similarly, if the Earth somehow was infinitely old, vastly older, the oceans would be so saturated with salt it would be like the Dead Sea. That clearly is also not the case. Now, while Halley himself did not give an answer, the Irish geologist John Joly, in the 1990s, using Halley's method with modern data, estimated that if you started with initially freshwater oceans, to get them to the level of salinity that we see today would require somewhere between 80 and 100 million years. Now, one can argue with the details of the method, but the basic idea is there. We're trying to find a physical age for the Earth, which means you need to find a process that takes time, that has a measurable progress in time. Ask where it started, and ask then, how long does it take to get there? So the assumption is you start with freshwater oceans, how long does it take to get to saline oceans? Now, in reality, the way the oceans were, in fact, probably formed, they probably formed with relatively high salinity that they have today. So this method isn't sound. It doesn't give a good answer. We don't believe it. But it shows, it's a very good illustration of the way in which you can approach the idea of a physical process. Find a physical process that plays out in time, come up with an assumption about what its initial state should be, and ask how long does it take to get to the state we observe today. That gives you at least a measurement of the time scale for that process to work. And since that process has worked on the Earth must be at least that old. It may not give you the ultimate age, but it tells you it has to be at least that old. Here's an example of one that actually is on a somewhat firmer basis, but again, it has some issues to it. Well, it was a French nobleman by the name of Georges-Louis Leclerc, the Comte de Buffon, who lived in the 18th century, who made a physical estimate based on a different physical parameter. He said, look, the Earth probably started out in a hot molten state. We see that residual molten state because there are volcanoes that belch up hot molten rock. If we make the assumption that the Earth started out in an initially molten state, but today it's mostly cool, how long would it take the Earth to cool from that initially molten state to the cool temperatures we see today? Now, he did a series of experiments to get the cooling rate. He heated up iron spheres. It turned out to be a reasonable proxy for a planet, he thought. You would heat them up until they were red hot, just about to melt, and then measure how long it took for them to cool off. Now, his hands were so torn up from various experiments, he enjoyed using the, as he said, the gentle hands of the young women who visited him on his estate were the best to use for judging when the sphere was cool to a particular point. There's some sort of charming French nobility nonsense going on in here. But basically, he came up with a series of observations and estimated that if you started out with the Earth at a completely molten state, he estimated it would take about 75,000 years to cool down to the current cool state. Again, a very large number. But in fact, he had some wrong numbers. For one, his iron spheres were cooling off faster. The composition of the Earth is different. You have to worry about how heat conduction works. So his simple idea of taking iron spheres from a forge and scaling up to the size of the Earth had some flaws in it. Lord Kelvin of the Kelvin temperature scale revised this estimate in the 1890s and found that, in fact, you would get a number between 20 and 400 million years for much more realistic estimates of how heat gets out of the Earth and what residual heat was remaining in the Earth itself. Again, these estimates have various flaws in them, but they're pointing in the same direction. Even relatively naive physical processes or simplified physical processes are leading you in a direction of very old ages for the Earth. The next level of taking this question down is how we view the history of the Earth, the physical history of the Earth, comes from James Hutton, who lived in the 18th century and is considered by many to be the father of modern geography. He wrote a book in 1795 called The Theory of the Earth that was an immensely influential geology textbook. He introduced into geology the concept of repair, the idea that the terrain of the Earth is not simply decay from a simple initial point, but in fact can be renovated. You can have new earth. And he pointed out, for example, things like volcanic eruptions that build new islands, that build new landforms, soil building up. As you dig down into the earth, you can see the evidence of ancient landforms. So the idea that people had before was that you sort of made the earth and then you kind of let it kind of wear out. What Hutton was showing was that very clearly the earth is not simply wearing out. Its surface is constantly being renewed and repaved. His conclusion from this was that these cycles of geological renewal and repaving take extremely long periods of time, literally millions of years. The problem is, he found that these cycles of destruction and renewal tended to erase some of that past history. So on the one hand, he established the deep antiquity of the earth, but on the other hand, he seemed to despair of the possibility that you might not be able to read the ultimate history because it has a tendency to erase itself. It's kind of like looking at a chalkboard. You don't see everything that was always written on the chalkboard because someone can come by and erase it and overwrite it. Well, in fact, Hutton went one step too far, but the basic idea was correct. We do, in fact, see that the Earth's history is much more rich than simply a decay from some initial state. This is an example of showing some of Hutton's data. You would dig down below a road cut here. This is outside of Jedburgh, Scotland. He found that the recent sediments that were laid down here were nice horizontal layers, one after another. But if you dug down deeper, you would see, in fact, that those sediments are uplifted and tilted, some of them, in fact, fully horizontal. He called these an unconformity. Not a very nice word, but basically you see that this sort of layering upon layering is interrupted. And all of a sudden something very dramatic happened at some time in the past before the first of those layers was upended. A more dramatic place to see this is basically here off the Scottish coast, where we see vertical rocks underneath and then the horizontal layers on top of it, where there's been various upheavals revealing pieces of this history laid out in the rocks. This was an extremely important idea. And it was the lead to work later in the 18th and into the 19th century by Charles Lyell. It was Lyell who introduced the idea that these different strata, these different layers in the earth, in fact, said basically Hutton was wrong. You can read the history of the earth in these layers. You just have to pay attention to the contents of those layers, not simply their shapes and arrangements as you dig deep into the ground. What he did was he used strata of different types of rocks, but was able to identify those same types of rocks elsewhere on the earth to basically read off the geological history of our planet. Furthermore, he noticed that in some of these strata there were fossils, many of them of creatures which no longer exist today, that are extinct, that would appear in those same layers at different places on the earth. And so you could tie down definitively the appearance of one layer versus another because of not only the minerals that are present, but also the fossils that are present, the remnant of the life that was alive at the time that those layers were laid down. And the reason for doing this is because superficially, if I brought you two rocks and laid them on the table, you could not tell the old rock from the new rock. Rock is kind of rock, at least superficially speaking. But life shows a great deal of variation with time. The types of creatures that live in a particular place, the type of plants that live in a place, may be substantially different today than 1 million or 2 million or 100 million years in the past. Climate changes, evolution occur. Well, you didn't know about evolution, but basically the changes of species over time occurs and different creatures exist. You find dinosaur bones, for example, in 100 million year old layers, but virtually no mammals. 10 million year old layer, it's all mammals. There's no dinosaurs anywhere in sight. That's kind of coarse grained, but it's the basic idea. He wrote a book called The Principles of Geology, which was in the same way as Hutton's to be highly influential. It laid the fundamental basis of modern geology. In fact, so heavily influenced generation of scientists that the book textbook was one of the first really big blockbuster bestseller textbooks in the world. It lived long past the end of Lyell's life. It also had the particular effect of influencing a young man by the name of Charles Darwin, who saw in Lyell's work that the history of the world was in fact very deep and very ancient. And that was to influence his thinking when he, just before he began his fateful voyage on the HMS Beagle to look at the life and fossils of the Southern Hemisphere and began the line of thinking that was eventually to lead him to the theory of evolution. But that's a different story for a different day. So let's bring it forward. I've made a statement, and Lyle made the statement, that a rock is a rock is a rock. But is that really true? Can I, in fact, distinguish an old rock from a new rock? How would I tell? Well, what you want to look for in any physical age is you want to look for a physical process that plays out in time. It turns out atoms give us a natural time clock in the form of radioactive decay. And if we can look at radioactive elements that are embedded within that solid rock and look at the products of that radioactive decay, we can actually piece together how old that rock is, how much time has elapsed since that rock was assembled, when it cooled and crystallized out of a molten state. So let's take a particular example that's very commonly used for age dating the Earth today. Zircons, zirconium silicate crystals, are wonderful crystals. Not only are they pretty, they're often used. Cubic zirconiums are used as fake diamonds. You stay up late at night, you'll see all kinds of people trying to sell you cubic zirconium. But zircons actually have a couple of particularly nice properties. One of them is they're really tough. They're a hard crystal. They're hard to break down, which means they can survive some pretty rough abuse, which means they can last a very long time. The other property is that they chemically can take up uranium inside of their crystalline structure. Uranium is very close chemically to the structures of both zirconium and silicon, and so if there's any uranium around when the crystal is forming, when it solidifies out of molten material, you will trap uranium isotopes inside the crystalline matrix of zircon. Why does this matter to us? Well, the reason it matters is all of the naturally occurring forms of uranium are radioactively unstable. They're born with too many neutrons. And too many neutrons means eventually those neutrons are going to turn into protons, or worse, uranium is even crazier. It actually spits off pieces and fissions. And so it very quickly, well, relatively quickly, uranium isotopes of different types will actually transform themselves into isotopes of lead. It will emit fission off particles. There are two primary isotopes that concern us of uranium. Uranium-238, all uranium has, I'm going to probably get this wrong, 92 protons and some large number of neutrons. Uranium-238 and uranium-235 are the principal forms of uranium. Uranium-238 is the most common. Uranium-235 is the one that everyone would love to purify out. That's the bomb uranium. Okay. Uranium-238 goes through a decay chain which ends up at lead-206. Lead-206 is stable. It no longer decays. So once you make lead-206, lead stays lead forever. Uranium-235 decays into lead-207. Lead-206 with one extra neutron. So they're easily distinguishable by their weights. The half-lives are very different, however. Uranium-238 to lead-206 has about a 4.5 billion year half-life. So if I start out with a kilo of pure uranium-238, I have to wait 4.5 billion years before I end up with a half a kilo of uranium-238 and a half a kilo of lead-206. Uranium-235, the bomb uranium, decays into lead-207 with a shorter half-life of 700 million years in round numbers. I'll give the exact number up there. What this means is if I had a kilo of pure uranium-235 and I lock it away somewhere in a safe place for 700 million years and come back, I would find that half of the uranium-235 would have decayed into your lead-207. So I would look at my pure uranium-235 sample, and 700 million years later, it would be half and half lead and uranium. But not just any lead, lead-207. So here's the key. Both of these lead isotopes are stable. There's a further important piece of information. When the zircon forms, lead is chemically rejected from the matrix. No matter how much lead I have present when I form a zircon crystal, there will be no lead in the final crystal. It's chemically rejected at the outset. So if I take a zircon crystal and I see one that just got burped out by molten lava out of a brand new volcano, it'll have uranium and absolutely zero lead content. But if I look at a 4.5 billion year old zircon, it's got lead inside of it. There's only one place that lead could have come from the uranium originally included that decayed into lead. In other words, it started with uranium but ends up with lead. The toughness of the zircon carries the key. It keeps the products of the radioactive decay in the same place as the parent radioactive elements. And by looking at the proportions of these, I can tell what's going on. So what I should expect over time is that you start out with some mix of uranium-238 and 235, but as we go through time, they're going to decay at different rates. And they're going to leave behind accumulating different amounts of these two different lead isotopes. We're also going to get slow changes in the isotope ratio of lead. So we can combine this information together to piece together the age of the rock. I have a clock. I have a physical process that plays out in time. And I actually have two clocks, a slow clock and a fast clock. And I can see how fast they move apart. So it's a self-calibrating clock. It's a beautiful technique. Here's an illustration of how this works. We'll just take a look at uranium-235. Let's start out with a zircon hypothetical that has 100 atoms of uranium-235 and zero, because it's zircon, of lead-207. I then let the uranium-235 decay. So I start, crystallize the zircon, say go. Eventually what happens? Let's wait 5 half-lives. So I have the amount of uranium, then I have the remaining uranium, so there's a quarter left. Have it again, there's an eighth left. Have it again, there's a 16th left. Have it again, there's a 32nd left. So I'm down to 1/32nd of the uranium atom left. There are 3 atoms of uranium-235 left after 5 half-lives. But there are now 97 atoms of lead. By looking at the change in that proportion, as I look at the ratio of lead-207 to uranium-235, I can read off how many half-lives have elapsed since the crystal formed. Since I know what the half-life is, bingo, we measured the date. Of course, the problem is, how do I know how much uranium it started with? Well, you don't. But you have a second isotope, which decays at a different rate. And you look at where the lines cross. Okay, here's an illustration of how it works. We start out with some mix. It doesn't matter what that mix is, it turns out. If you're pure uranium-238 and 235 and no lead, 4.5 billion years ago. You then let it roll for 4.5 billion years. Lead-238 has a 4.5 billion year half-life, so half of it is gone, half of it is left, and the other half is turned into lead-206. But uranium-235 has a 700 million year half-life. In 4.5 billion years, it goes through about 6.4 half-lives, which means only 1.2% of the original uranium-235 is left, and all the rest, the other 98.8%, has been transformed into lead-207. So what you see is the ratio of 238 to lead-206 and uranium-235 to lead-207, two different clocks running at two different rates. When you cross them, you get the age of the rock. I'm not going to explain this in detail, but this is a plot of the ratio of lead-206 to uranium-238, parent and daughter product, to the ratio of lead-207 to uranium-235, daughter and parent. These are the measurements. This is the theoretical estimate from the half-life, and it crosses the line right there. This particular zircon from a place called the Funds Belt in Zimbabwe is 2.6 billion years old. It's called a concordance diagram, a Concordia diagram. So by using the two different isotope ratios, you can pin down the age really quite accurately, better than you can do with only one isotope all by itself. And it has the beauty that you don't need to know how much uranium it started with. You just know that the proportions are going to cross as the two clocks cross. They both started out the same. The two clocks have to give you the same time. There's only one and only one combination that will give you that time. Now, of course, things get a little dicey when you get super young. So the answer is pretty... You pay attention to this part up here, not down at the beginning. That's part of the error budget. All right. So what's the answer that we get? Well, we combine together a number of different age dating techniques. We find, in fact, a very common answer and a very well accurate result. The uranium lead method that I just described can be used to actually, if you have a 2.5 billion year old rock, a 2.5 billion year old crystallized zircon, you can measure its age to about 0.1%, about a 2 million year margin. That's pretty darn good. I mean, 2 million years seems huge to us, but on a geological timescale, that's 0.1%. How many of you know your age right now this instant to a tenth of a percent? How good were those hospital records? We can look at a lot of other... There are other radiometric methods. We don't just rely on uranium. There are other combinations. Samarium to neodymium, rubidium to strontium, potassium to argon have different clock lengths ranging from hundreds of millions of years, 50 billion years to 130 billion years. So here's our use of our giga year here. You use different combinations of these because different rocks have different different chemical properties. Some survive better than others. You combine the data, and what you get is the same game you're playing before. Do I get a consistent result? Now, there's a little wee problem here. I've mentioned that you have to use these radioactive age dating. It doesn't tell you the age of the Earth. It tells you the age of the rock. More precisely, what it tells you is the time since that rock, since that mineral or crystal solidified out of a molten state, reached a solid state where it locked in all of the elements that eventually are going to lead to the decay of the radioactive clock. Now, what happens when a mineral or a crystal solidifies? The chemically allowed elements are going to be locked in. The chemically rejected elements are going to be locked out. When you crystallize a zircon, you lock in the uranium, you kick out the lead, if there's any lead present in the soup that it's crystallizing out of. The daughter products of the locked-in radioactive elements are going to stay locked inside that matrix, provided two things don't happen. Number one, the rock is crushed and broken down so that you actually begin to scramble things up, or even worse, you take that rock and you remelt it. Once you remelt it, you've reset the clock. You've now turned it back into a liquid state, and everything gets freely mixed, and you lose because, oh, I'm in a crystal and I'm in a liquid state. Chemically, you start rejecting the lead and hanging on to the uranium. You literally reset the clock. So what you measure by using a radioactive age date, whether it's a rubidium strontium or lead uranium or the various methods, is you measure the amount of time that has elapsed since that rock formed. And clearly you can't do this with all rocks or all minerals, because not all minerals are going to be durable enough to survive long periods, or are going to have the right kind of mix of chemical acceptance and chemical rejection to let you build up these clocks. But there are a lot of minerals and common ones that do. So this is the caveat in this. So how do you use this to measure the age of the Earth? Well, what you do is the Earth is geologically active, it tends to remelt rocks, so you have to find the oldest rock. It's kind of like looking at, let's say I didn't know what the ages of people or the ages of a civilization was. I can keep pushing back until I find the oldest thing. Eventually, I'm going to run out of old things. That's your start. Same true as with the Earth. You look for older and older and older rocks, but eventually you hit a wall. You reach a point where you never find anything older, and that sets the limit on the age of the Earth. Turns out that most of the Earth's crust is actually pretty young. The Earth is very geologically active. On average, if you went out and grabbed any average rock just randomly off the ground, it's probably about 100 million years old. Because the continents are continually shifting. There's constantly going to be eruptions of volcanoes, subduction of stuff. We're going to see later on the Earth is very active. So most of the rocks have been solidified and remelted and resolidified many, many times over during the history of the Earth. So we have to seek the world's oldest rocks. And where we seek these is in the middle of the largest continents. These are the oldest rocks, the places geologists call the continental shields. There's a couple of these places around on the Earth. For example, the Jack Hills of Australia is the current record winner. It's in the middle of the Australian continental shield. We find zircons there that recently have been dated to 4.4 billion years. In Canada, there's a series of rock formations called the Akashic Gneiss, which are about 4 billion years old. And in Greenland, there's a greenstone belt called Issua, which has dating back to 3.8 billion years. And here's a nice example of some of these ancient rocks here. This is a 4.25 billion year old rock from Canada. So they're rare. The Earth has been so active, it's hard to find them. So we have to go outside the Earth. Meteorites are left over and solidified at the formation of the solar system. So crystalline inclusions and meteorites should be the oldest rocks in the solar system, and indeed they are. The moon's surface crystallized and solidified much earlier than the Earth's. The moon is not as geologically active, and so it too is going to give us the oldest rocks. So using a combination of meteoritic rocks, the oldest Earth rocks, and moon rocks, we can pin down the age of the Earth to 4.54 plus or minus 0.05 billion years, a margin of about 50 million years, or about 1%. This is consistent with all of the age dates that we've been able to find, and so it pushes back. We never find a 5-billion-year-old rock or a 6-billion-year-old rock. We really do run out at about 4.6 billion years. That's about the oldest thing we've ever seen. So this firmly establishes the great and deep antiquity of the Earth. Why does this matter to us? Because it gives us time, lots and lots of time, for slow processes to play out. Lots of time for life to arise, to change, and evolve. And that's a question we're going to pick up when we go on further in this class and talk about the nature of life and the history of the Earth. Okay, any questions? See you all tomorrow then.